So I'd like to continue on here now with the next part of our exploration of the four foundations of mindfulness. For those of you who have not been here for a little bit, we've been exploring this particular teaching of the Buddha, his primary teaching on meditation, for a few weeks now. The four foundations of mindfulness are what you actually pay attention to in the process of meditation. They're the actual ingredients, or the structure, you might say, of your direct and immediate experience of life. The function of the meditation, the function of the sutra or sermon on the four foundations of mindfulness, is to give you access to your original nature, to help you remember or recollect or know again or awaken to what you really are. In order for this to happen, the prevalent, and you might say at times seemingly firmly conditioned, perceptual distortions that you take to be reality have to be seen through. Actually, what happens is you, as you think of yourself, do not awaken. Awakening happens, and who you think you are is what falls away. When who you think you are, or what you think you are, falls away, what remains, or what can shine forth, or come through, you might say, is what you really are. Now, any description that we give, as I've been saying before, is just a description. The word is not the thing. So the meditation and the purpose of the talk is to assist us in the felt sense of things, not the thoughts of these things, but rather the felt sense. So the feeling sense, in other words, the body, right, this aliveness of the body, the sensing into how the body responds in the meditation, how the body responds in the talk. That's what we can be paying attention to, you could say. We're going to begin to talk tonight about what's called fruition consciousness. We're going to begin to talk about the seven factors of enlightenment. In the Buddhist teachings, the seven factors of enlightenment are called expressions of fruition consciousness. Now, this consciousness that's being referred to is not a solid thing, as we talked about last week. The fifth aggregate is consciousness. And this consciousness is not the consciousness that some people refer to or think about. It's a consciousness that's momentary and is of the object. It arises and passes extremely fast. There's a different consciousness for hearing, seeing, tasting, smelling, thinking, and so forth. Those are, you could say, units of consciousness or moments of consciousness that arise and pass with the object. Now, just sitting here right now, notice that there may be a perception that there's a consciousness that is stable and consistent, and that what is happening is actually passing through that consciousness. This is a perception. And sometimes it's a very firmly held perception. It's an invested in perception. It's an agreed upon perception. Okay, the conquest of misunderstanding or the conquest of illusion. The actual, you could say from a more Hindu perspective, the release from Maya is the ultimate, you might say, human birthright. It's the ultimate possibility for the human being. And therefore, in a way, it asks for all of you. It asks for a total interest or commitment, or as it's said by one teacher, Nisargadatta Maharaj, a total earnestness. He was once quoted as saying, earnestness matters most. Getting exposed to the possibility of this ultimate human birthright is critical. Because if you don't know about it, if you're not exposed to it, then how does it come about? I mean, even here right now on planet Earth, all 6.5, if it's 6.5 billion of us, can you notice in your immediate associations how there are many people who might have no interest in what we're talking about here tonight? Like, you couldn't get one sentence of this stuff out, and they're off onto something else, or the hand's going like this, or, oh, there's that spiritual this and that, and what are you talking about? Naval contemplation? Is that it? What'd you do tonight? And they're sincere. They actually mean it. Even if they're kidding, they're sincerely kidding. They mean what they think or they feel. So you have to be exposed. Otherwise, you're not going to know about it. And why is it that some human beings get exposed, and once they get exposed, they deeply pay attention? And there's others who could be called shoppers. And it's okay to look around at different spiritual practices or spiritual traditions. But like as one of my teachers once said, if you want water in the earth, you need a drill until you hit the water. You can't be doing 2 feet over here. Well, I don't like that hole. 3 feet over here. Oh, that's not the one. 6 inches over here. No, 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 that's wrong. And pretty soon you've dug all these holes and you haven't gotten any water. That's like a person who just keeps shopping. That doesn't mean that through the course of your life you actually will stay with the same, say, meditation practice or the same body of teachings. Eventually what happens is you begin to see that any meditation practice, any spiritual teaching that you really take all the way to the water gets you the water. In this case, the water is the gift. As Rumi called it, it's the gift. It's the promise. It's the illumination. It's the deliverance. It's the salvation. It's the nirvana. It's the happiness. It's the freedom. It's your birthright realized. So we're talking about realization. We can't think our way to it. We can't even feel our way to it. There's actually, ultimately, nothing we can do about it. And so to describe what I'm going to describe tonight will once again make this appear like a linear, progressive path. And that's the way our mind is organized and needs to relate to it. But the true path fruition, or fruition consciousness, is not a progression. And it doesn't happen to someone. In fact, it's quite inside out. Awakening, we were talking about this last week when you asked about awakening, what is it? And I listened to the tape and I thought through what I had responded. And the final sort of thing that I said that night, last night, or last week, right, was that awakening is everything. Everything is awakening. Okay? Everything is as it is already. Everything is arising naturally, spontaneously. Thus also, realizing what you really are, as defined as a falling away of what you're not, happens spontaneously to no one. It doesn't happen to the sense of you. It's the sense of you, as you perceive that, that falls away. In that falling away, it's as if the flower breaks open and shows its essence. So, why then do we meditate? Partly because we don't know what or who we really are, and we're interested. From the moment of separation, from the moment of realization that there is a possibility that what you perceive as limitation or bondage can be resolved, you then are a seeker. You then begin to look. You begin to practice. You begin to listen. You begin to read. You begin to study. It's the falling away of the seeker. It's the falling away of the seeking that is the awakening. That's why I say you actually don't awaken. And yet, to say it another way, you do. Okay, but it's just not who you think you are that awakens. Okay? And again, these are just words pointing at this. This is not something that the description actually does justice to. There is no description that truly does justice to anything. The word is not the thing. So we talked about the contemplation of the body, contemplation of the feelings, contemplation of the mind, and then we begin to get into the contemplation of the dharmas or the mind objects, the five so-called hindrances, desire, wanting mind, aversion, anger, hatred, restlessness, sleepiness, and doubt. Then we looked into the five aggregates, body feeling, mental formation, perception, consciousness, and the six sense bases, okay, which are what let us know that we're quote-unquote in this world. The only way you know that you're in this world is through your sense organs and the function of your mind. Okay, when you go into deep sleep and you know not your sense experience, you know not your mind experience, you know not your emotional experience, you don't know this world. It's a different world in a way, as this body lays still and quiet. It's quite a great, fantastic, beautiful, simple mystery, which we're still trying to figure out scientifically what's going on in sleep, and the study and the research goes on quite nicely. Books coming out about it, new research about sleep, new courses on sleep. Courses on how to sleep, they're interesting. Levels of courses on how to sleep and what you can do when you sleep. How to get to sleep, stay asleep, wake up in your sleep, so forth and so on. It's quite interesting. So the six sense bases, the five aggregates, the five hindrances, and now the seven factors of enlightenment. They're beautiful teaching. The seven of them. And again, these qualities or states of feeling or consciousness or mind moments, you can call them whatever you like, they are tastes of liberation. That's all. They're tastes. They're like the tip of the chocolate eclair. If the chocolate eclair is what you really are, then this is the tip of the chocolate eclair. I like that image a little better than the tip of the iceberg. It's a little warmer to the taste buds, the tip of the chocolate eclair. What's the first? Let me say this first. There are seven. Three are what are called the arousing factors or energizing factors, and three are called the balancing factors, and then one is the integrating factor or unifying factor. Okay? Remember, these are just states of consciousness. These arise and pass. As you become, you might say, less caught up in identification with anything, particularly the sense of yourself as a separate being, but anything else that you're identified with, that you fixate upon, that consciousness fixates upon, as that loosens up, as your personal issues, wherever they're coming from, your past, your childhood, your adolescence, things that didn't work, jobs you've had, people that liked you, didn't like you, as those fixations loosen up, as your energy becomes more free and available in the moment. Okay. You are experiencing the first factor of enlightenment. It's called energy. As this energy that's right, really right here all the time, as this energy that we are becomes free to be here, flowing, lucid, vibrant. Okay, and sometimes we will read a teaching, or we'll hear a talk, or we'll go to a place, a beautiful place. We'll see a beautiful a play, maybe a movie, music, and this energy will come. There'll be an energetic sort of boost. Do you know what I'm talking about? Okay, people get this energy thing when they fall in love. Okay, and they get in the infatuation. This is about all this energy that moves through. Granted, it may not be all that liberating, it may actually be imprisoning, but nonetheless, here it comes, because it's mixed up sometimes there, that love thing gets mixed up with attachment. I get lost in there, what's the difference between being attached and being in love? I love you, he said to her, or she said to him. I can't live without you, as the attachment. I want what's best for you, as long as it's good for me too. Don't leave me. If you do, think of me often. I want you to be free. And on we go with these ideas about love. If we could interview love, love has no ideas about itself. Love is unself-conscious. Love is uninhibited. So love is a kind of energy. So this energy is the first factor of enlightenment. As we meditate, for example, this energy arises, and there's a sense that it's filling this whole thing. There's an energy that becomes clearer and more unified, and it feels very good. It often has with it pleasant feeling. You know what I'm talking about? You have a sense of this? Even if you don't meditate, you know something about this factor of enlightenment. If you meditate, if you practice periods of time of stillness and non-interfering with experience, letting experience be, dropping out of excessive thinking, particularly judgmental and comparative and planning and remembering, and there's this settling of the body-mind process, then you begin to naturally feel this energy. It's very nice. And sometimes in the teachings they'll make a sort of a simile or a synonym, actually a synonym, between energy and effort. When energy is strong in life, when energy is balanced, when energy is full, activities, and even meditation as a sort of activity, becomes effortless. It's just happening. Even the body, people report, the body is just up, and they don't have to even feel like they're holding it up. It just kind of stays up. It gets kind of buoyant. It gets kind of light. It's getting enlightened. So this energy then opens us into the next factor. The next factor is called investigation. This is a really important factor, not only in life, but in the realization of what we really are. Without energy, obviously, there'll be no investigation. So the investigation starts out as partial. It starts out as bias. Okay? Look at this for a moment. There's certain things that you probably are very willing and even able to investigate in your life. How deeply have you investigated the roots of anger? How deeply have you investigated the roots of desire? How deeply have you investigated anything, really? How deeply have you really looked? This investigation starts with a partialness or a bias based in part on your conditioning, what you've learned, what you've been taught, what you've been invited or told to pay attention to. And you'll notice that some people have a very strong sense of investigation, but it's in a particular area. And they're very focused in that area, and they know a lot about that body of information or so forth and so on. What this investigation is about is the investigation of direct experience that's happening moment to moment for the human being. Okay, and again, even there, it starts out bias or prejudice. Some people be very willing to pay attention to their feelings and investigate those feelings, but they don't want to investigate their thinking, or vice versa. They'll investigate certain feelings with eagerness and enthusiasm, but other ones, no, 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 not those. No, no, later maybe. Those feelings come up? No. I don't like those feelings. I put off that till later. I don't want that at all. And so forth and so on. What happens is that investigation broadens, becomes all-inclusive. There's nothing outside the scope. So it goes from in here, narrow, particular, bias, prejudice, boom, opens. Whatever is arising, this is what I mean by life, everything is awakening. Everything that's arising is equally valid. And revealing the teachings of the Dharma, the truth of the way things really are, no higher, no lower, no better, no worse, goes right past that, and the investigation becomes thorough, deep, unbiased. And this is where joy comes. And the teachings, it's called rapture sometimes, or pithi. Pithi is the Pali word for rapture. The kind of joy that we have sometimes when something good happens to us. I don't know, anybody have anything good happen lately? Something nice happens to someone else and you can have sympathetic joy, like you feel happy for them. You know, oh, you got in, oh, great. You got accepted, you applied for that, wonderful. This is a kind of joy, very often momentary, but nice. Okay, this joy that I'm talking about now, that's born from energy, that's born from investigation, this joy, okay, needs no object. What starts happening is this joy arises spontaneously and starts to fill the mind and fill the body. And in a sense, it doesn't matter what's happening. The joy blankets it, touches it, moves through it. penetrates it. It's amazing. What happens in the meditation sometimes is people get the whole body, or at least parts of the body, will just like go into goose flesh. It'll just be like so exhilarating. And again, here we have a very powerful arising factor and potentially imbalancing, because people get overexcited and they lose the balance. They get kind of manic even. So this joy is very important, because again, there's a happiness in this joy, momentary as it is. As this joy matures, as you'll see, we talk about these other factors, as it's, you could say, melded in or unified with the other factors of fruition consciousness, it becomes happiness. Happiness is different than joy. It becomes contentment. Contentment is different than joy. It becomes fulfillment. Fulfillment. That's why we have different words for these things. Fulfillment is different than joy. If they were the same, they'd have the same word. And we get to find out what these things mean, not just think about them, and not just take someone else's definition. We get to actually directly experience this. Okay, got those three? Energy, investigation, and joy. Now we move to the unifying factors, or balancing factors. Better word would be balancing. Concentration. Equanimity. And tranquility. Now, don't say it, but just guess. What's the seventh factor? Don't say it. If you got it, hold it. Lightly. Concentration. We know about concentration because we've been concentrated at times. Our focus gets into something, and to some extent, small or large, everything else goes away. You watch a child sometime who has this natural concentration, and they get in and they're drawing on the picture, and they are just absorbed in there. And you could say something to them and they wouldn't even hear you. Unless you might have said it loud enough, and then you'd startle them out of that. But that natural concentration that we knew from childhood serves us very well throughout the course of our whole life. But let us differentiate two basic kinds of concentration. There's what's called moment-to-moment concentration, which is what's going on in this room right now, to some extent. And then there is absorptive concentration. There's a concentration that you could call one-pointed concentration. One-pointed concentration is a little bit more rare, although we've all experienced this. It is where the attention is placed on a particular object, like, for example, the breathing. And that practice of absorptive concentration, or one-pointed concentration, is cultivated to the extent that everything else goes away. All the hindrances go away, and there's just, boom. Total focus. It feels amazing. Especially the first time it happens consciously. It's an amazing experience. Very transitory, of course, but it's a very, very nice state. One-pointed concentration. In the meditation, more often, although some teachers do teach this one-pointed samadhi or one-pointed concentration, and they use that as a springboard to then be able to develop insight. And there's a lot of sort of differentiation about how much of this one-pointed concentration one would need. How much do you need? Like on a scale of 0 to 10, do you need a 7 or an 8? And then you can spring. How about those who can only make it to 4 or 3? I had a friend that had just come back from Burma some years back, and he said as soon as he got to the monastery in Rangoon, this is before you couldn't go soon. It's harder to go now, and when you go to Burma now, there's a price ticket of about $300 as soon as you walk in. They just take $300 right out of your pocket. This is your ticket to come to this country. Anyways, you go to the monastery, and these monks who were teaching, they expected you to be able to have one point of concentration for 20 minutes unbroken before we even start. If you don't have that, what are you doing here? Kind of like that attitude. Well, I guess I need to take a preliminary course. I'll be back in a year. You just expect it. You know, you can't do this, and then we can't teach you the other stuff we want to teach you. So you can see that that's actually in our culture fairly rare. How many people have one point of concentration for 20 minutes at will? We're much more accustomed to moment-to-moment concentration. Okay? And that actually looks like mindfulness, but it's a little bit different. Okay? Concentration actually is a lesser, you could say, degree of absorption on the changing flow of experience. Okay, notice how experience is changing in here. It's not static. Things are moving. Not just these words. There's an experience inside so-called this body-mind process that's moving and changing. Concentration is like resting into that changing phenomena with a degree, again, important word, degree of unbrokenness. And so, again, that often feels very good to not be distracted. Now, when that moment-to-moment concentration is strong and balanced with the other factors, then even distraction can arise, anger can arise, fear can arise, any state can arise. It's fine. It's fluid too. And of course, a lot of this has to do with whether the states are fixated upon or identified with. The stronger the sense of self, the stronger the sense of egoic, you could say, force, the more problematic a person's life is, period. Look at it. It's so obvious that a person who's strongly egotistical needs the attention, needs to be seen, needs to be known. Others tolerate, but often behind that person's back they say, "Isn't he obnoxious? He must be very insecure. He's so needy." The stronger the sense of identification with an I or me, whatever that I or me is, the more conflicted that individual's life is, period. The less fixated, the less caught in identification with anything, particularly a sense of I or me, the more free and fluid and actually beautiful and easy life is. Does that make sense? It's almost statistics. So, when there isn't as much fixation or identification with things, anything, then this concentration, this moment-to-moment concentration, when balanced with other factors, can allow whatever it is that's arising. Because the true nature of everything is actually the same for all things. What is that true nature? Everything has its beginning and its ending, with only transition in between. That's why there's no solid self. Because anything you could point to that you say, "This is myself," is actually a dynamic, fluid process of arising and passing with only transition in between. No solidity. And the concentration, albeit an impermanent state, aids in opening this up so that it can be realized. Then we have equanimity. It's hard to actually talk about these states as distinct because they really don't operate in isolation. They operate like a family. They operate like a nice, healthy group of friends. Equanimity is non-reactivity, and it particularly comes in handy when dealing with things like the hindrances: sleepiness, desire, restlessness, confusion, doubt, so forth and so on. when these states are arising in this equanimity. The equanimity, you might say, allows that state to just simply come and go. It's like balance or equipoise. So people can sit or move through life at times, and there can be this equanimity where there's non-reactivity to what's happening. There's a responsiveness to the flow of experience. Still dualistic, as I'm describing it, of course. Any language is dualistic. There is no language that isn't dualistic. The very arising and use of language is dualistic. There's words that are can be used a little bit more accurately for some of us to point to non-dual truth. But the words are not non-dual truth. Like oneness, for example. Okay, oneness is all that is. There isn't anything but oneness. You can't have more oneness or less oneness. You can't add to the oneness. Oneness is all there is. Everything that's happening is oneness. It's not two. But the mind, in describing this or thinking about this, divides it up by the simple use of language as a beginning point. So I'm describing equanimity as a state that meets whatever's arising in openness and non-reactivity. It's responsive. And again, very handy when dealing with afflictive states like fear or jealousy, anger, irritation, frustration, the feeling of not getting what's wanted, of getting what isn't wanted. Okay, when these qualities arise, equanimity is very, very healthy and handy, because what it does is it helps allow that state to move through more fluidly. It's so important, actually, in the Buddhist teachings, this equanimity, that there is a certain section of one of the scriptures where they describe equanimity as the highest state. Notice the dualism. If there's a higher, there has to be a lower. So, the highest state. Interesting, huh? They didn't say pitti, joy. They didn't say concentration. They didn't say mindfulness. They said equanimity is the highest state. Ah. Did the Buddha say that, or did that get into the translation? Who put that in there? We'll never know. But I think it's interesting. Do you? And do you agree? Not that you should or shouldn't. Do you know what equanimity is? Let me give a little example. It's slightly political. If you watch the presidential debates, regardless of your affiliation to party or whether you were independent or whatever you were thinking about doing in terms of voting or not voting, if you watch the debates, it was very clear at times that dear Mr. John McCain had reactivity in his mind and was gesticulating his body with this reactivity, and it was in his voice. Dear Mr. Obama seemed to not have at times this kind of reactivity, and in fact, even when being sort of attacked with heavy criticism, he would still try to get his turn in, at times speak to the monitor, can I get in on this one? And he would almost be smiling as he said it. And then he was criticized for not being emotional enough. Where's his feelings? How can we trust him? We're actually not very used to equanimity in our political figures or our families of origin, or even our community at large. People who actually are right in the middle of something, maybe heavy-duty something, and don't react. Responsiveness. Openness to the different points of view. This is equanimity. In the meditation, when it arises, it feels so sweet, because you can actually begin to think you're free. Remember, there isn't anyone who gets free, but you can start thinking you're the one mm-hmm. who's free and getting free. This is what equanimity sometimes does. So just a simple example from my own experience years ago, I was meditating for an extended period of time in retreat. And what started to happen was there was this very, very slow expansion of everything. Everything that I could sense that I was expanding. And it would go on for like a week. Just like, you know, every meditation, sitting, walking, standing, was just getting bigger, 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 bigger. And I was getting incredibly happy. Wow, unbelievable. This is so great. This is so great. This is so wonderful. Wow, wow, wow. There's no edge. Boo, 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 boo. And then boom, started contracting. 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, about 5 days, contracting, contracting, contracting. And then boom, turn around again. It was as if, almost like I was the universe, and I was breathing. And this went on several times, like a gigantic accordion. And here came the deeper insight. Slowly but surely, it became crystal clear that there was this unbelievably powerful preference for this. A liking of this and a disliking of this. And once that crystallized, once that got clear, it was as if the bottom trap door that I didn't even know existed opened out into space, and there was this equanimity that arose that revealed that it didn't matter whether it was doing this or doing this. There was no higher or lower, better or worse. It was very subtle. But with it, a happiness that was way beyond the expansion. So much more sublime, so much more fulfilling, so much more satisfying. And yet, equally impermanent. Equanimity. And then we have tranquility. We all know about peace of mind-body. What happens in the meditation is this peace of mind-body deepens so that the whole fabric, the whole texture, the whole process becomes tranquil, becomes still. The sensations of the body in tranquility become extremely fine, like tiny little effervescent bubbles, tiny, almost immeasurable, small, arising and passing. Very, very satisfying. Taste of freedom, but yet impermanent, arising and passing. Born from conditions. What conditions? Energy, investigation, joy, concentration, equanimity, tranquility. And now the seventh, mindfulness. None of these can be known, none of these six factors of awakening, of liberation, of enlightenment, can be known without mindfulness. Mindfulness again, bare attention, bare of judgment, bare of decision, bare of commentary. These seven factors are all developing in all human beings to varying degrees. You don't have to meditate to develop or culture these factors, but meditation has been proven to accelerate their development, to give you deeper, quicker access to them. Now it's said again, this is just conceptual, that true liberation is when these factors come into perfect balance. They come into perfect balance and there's a penetration through perceptual distortion. This is a definition of how enlightenment happens. Funny, huh? I think after a while, science, and it's going to be straight out there on the internet, there's going to be a description and probably a flow chart of how enlightenment happens. and whether it happens in the brain or not, and how much of the brain is involved, and do you need a brain? And it's all going to be laid out, I think, Rich. I think it is. Because there's people who want it to be laid out, and so they're going to go for it. So in the scriptures, many, many hundreds of years ago, it was said when these factors come into perfect harmony, energy, investigation, joy, concentration, equanimity, tranquility, and mindfulness come into perfect balance, boom. Illusion, perceptual distortion cannot hang around. It dissolves. You want us to hear that, or is that just for you two? Okay, good. See, I'm just a nosy guy. So let me see.